Hey, everybody. It is Writers in the Round. My guests are Christian Collier and Tiffany Herron. Christian and Tiffany are here, in part at least, to talk about the poet Jose Olivares, whose work they're going to be celebrating along with him at a Plug Poetry event on Saturday, the 22nd.
Absolutely.
And this is the first of hello, Tiffany.
Hi.
Christian, good to see you.
Likewise.
So, Plug Poetry is an... I never noticed that your endeavor was called Plug Poetry before. Is that one of your more recent endeavors, or is that just a different name for what you've always been doing?
Well, actually, the Plug, this coming April, will have been around for 1 year.
Oh, okay.
And it's the home of the docuseries. I did a documentary where we're really highlighting different writers in the contemporary poetry scene here. I mean, there's 6 episodes, so it's the home of that.
Is this video documentary?
Yes. So the first two are up right now. If people just type in Plug Poetry Project to into YouTube, I'm sure they'll pop up.
So how do you make a video documentary on a poet?
In a very interesting way, I thought.
You know, I think you would.
Well, the idea occurred to me, and I think we've actually talked about this before, that poetry, when the people who do think about poetry think about poetry, they think about a model that largely was established, you know, like 50, 60 years ago. You know, people gathered around in coffee shops and really kind of experiencing it in this intimate way. Mm. And that's increasingly isn't the way that the world works anymore. You know, so much of the world is experienced through cell phones and iPads and you know, devices like that. So and we're very much in the age of documentation. There's Instagram poetry and you know, social media definitely is like another medium. So I wanted to do something that allowed me to, A, tell a little bit of a story about the people that I've known, you know, in the city for a good number of years, but B, kind of hit people in stride where they don't have to really do anything different with their routine. They're already using the platform in which they can experience and interact with the work. And then if they've enjoyed the, you know, the episode that they've seen, the poems, the poets, they can then jump on Facebook in the Plug group and we can actually have a dialogue about it, you know?
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what I go for.
It's just a coffee house writ large, really, isn't it?
I think so. You know, I think that increasingly if you're of a certain age, the things that you were very familiar with, they still exist. They just look different. You know, like snail mail has been supplanted with email for a good number of years, but I think that's probably the best example off the top of my head of, you know, the way that you communicate it, it still works. It's just been exacerbated with technology. And I think that the more we kind of step into that, we can really get some cooler things. And the reach is expanded, and we're allowed to encounter people from, you know, the other side of the world, like, instantaneously. So I think that that's a really interesting thing.
It is, isn't it? And I'm not sure any of us have quite grasped what that means yet, that we could be right now talking to somebody on the other side of the world.
Sure.
You know, that's something that is unique to this generation.
Absolutely.
That's never happened before.
Yeah.
You know, except, you know, well, Friday was Valentine's Day, right? So All You Need Is Love came to mind. And that was, they sang that song originally on that broadcast that was the first time they put up a satellite sending a television signal around the world.
Mm.
And the Beatles were one of the people they wanted to, you know, play to the world.
Nice.
So that was the first time, really, that anybody had ever done anything like that. But for you and me, for anybody, really, to be able to have that same opportunity, that was just a little more than 50 years ago.
Sure.
So that's how quickly that's gone from, wow, isn't this cool? And this is on primetime television, and this is a big deal.
You know,
this is going to go all the way around the world. And now people do it, and they don't even think about it.
Sure.
But if you do think about it, and you start creating something with that in mind, then you do indeed have a coffee house writ large.
Absolutely. And I think that it has magnified what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we're so, you know, accustomed to, we deal with the people that we, you know, encounter on a daily basis. Or we know that we can, in one way, shape, or form, have a reach with. But no, all of us now kind of represent like global brands, you know, if you look at it that way, right?
Potentially.
Yeah.
Which, when you start talking about poets, Tiffany, poets, it seems to me, you know, if you've got 100 people in the room, you're thinking, this is pretty good.
Yeah, you absolutely. That's a lot. More than good.
So what do you think about all this? Have you given much thought to this? Does that interest you at all, or do you care about that? You know, does it matter to you to reach, you know, a wider, broader audience? Are you happy just to meet one person and share your poems?
Well, a little bit of both. I think that it's important for the existence of poetry to continue with excitement. You do have to reach those broader audiences. And part of the reason I think I went back to school and was because I was only sharing what I wrote with very select people. And I was kind of like, well, why am I doing this then if the only people that are getting to read this or hear me read it are a couple of people? I mean, what's the point?
Mm.
So it's nice that Christian and his connections and his hard work has been able to put this together, and it's very exciting too. And it's been very exciting to see the amount of support where I thought, and I've heard, you know, that poetry is dying, you know, so it's been exciting.
Mm. I think people have been saying poetry is dying for as long as there's been people writing it down.
Right. Know? Absolutely.
Do you have your poetry with you?
I have a few poems.
Would you care to share one?
Sure, sure. I write about a lot of different things, and there's not necessarily one theme that runs through all of them, but definitely there's a certain style, and Christian has told me I like my happy endings, which is fine, but I've learned a lot, and so over the years, I've been involved in certain things and passions about things. And one of the biggest is the environment. And I saw this photo of a caiman online with butterflies on its head. Now, it was the most beautiful thing I had seen in a long time, which was strange because it was a caiman, which people hate, you know. But so I wrote something about it called The Crowned Caiman. I'm going where I can still hear the honeybees. Because even their dead don't haunt this place anymore. I'm headed to where the sound of a purr and the rhythmic phrase of an owl makes me fall in love. I need to smell the brightness of water tossed with stars and fish, and I desire the scent of sun-warmed pine needles that will send me like a swift through the shadows of timber. The smoke is too thick now, so I'm going to see the frozen mountains where lilac snow glows under brilliant clouds, and to witness the expanse of valleys embracing moss and fern and lichen. Then I will adventure to the crunchy prairies where the boldness of brown Tatanka stampede in earnest. I'll be on my way to feel the mist of salt and jungle and the vivid syrup of fat vine fruit. And if I don't find the caiman with the butterfly crown, I will wander on foot until the anaconda's seduction drags me under and I feel its belly nestled like a baby until I become part of the earth where the potter frog will use me to keep her eggs safe.
Tiffany Herron, our guest, along with Christian Collier, they're both here, as I said, in part to talk about the Plug Poetry event, which is, it's actually several events, isn't it, on Saturday?
Sure. We have two events.
You have a workshop in the early part of the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the reading from Mr. Olivares. What time does that start, about 7:30?
We open doors at 6. We get running at 6:30. And that's like a hard 6:30. So if you come at 6:35, you're probably going to be like halfway through somebody's set, you know. But yeah, we have those two central events. This is no longer the case. The workshop, though, is generally always open to whoever wants to come. You know, I've had 4 books published. I have never written a poem. Everybody is equal and everybody's on the same page. But we were able to fill up, you know, all of the slots and then some, like, pretty fast. So, you know, you can't come to that. However, you can definitely come to the reading. We have more than enough space to accommodate you. So
tell us about Mr. Olivares.
Yeah. So when I first sat down, let me back up. I mentioned that the plug has the docuseries. And I was having a conversation with...
So that was the genesis for the plug project. They were kind of went hand in hand. You formed the plug poetry project in order to make documentaries?
Well, it was just that one documentary. You know, I wanted to give a platform for the writers that I've known. And I feel very, you know, fortunate because the poetry scene here is really kind of segregated in a way where you have people who will go to, say, the Barnes & Noble open mic at the end of most months who are typically older, whiter. They might not come downtown to see something that somebody of color would do, and vice versa. So you have people who've been active for the same amount of time who have no idea about each other's stories, each other's works. So I wanted to do something that would provide a bridge to those different communities. But yeah, the docuseries is the first thing that kind of came about. And then right after, I was having a conversation with my mentor, and the idea for a reading series came about. And so I scribbled out some names and contacted some people, and we were able to bring Julian Randall first, and then we brought Jericho Brown in October. But in that list of maybe 10 names, Jose's name was on there. And I first caught wind of him in an anthology that came out probably about 4 years ago now called The Breakbeat Poets. I think they're about to do the 4th installation of the anthology now, but he was in the first one. But I really fell in love with his work, with his personality and his work through his podcast. He's on a podcast called The Poetry Gods with John Sands and Aziza Barnes. That's just fantastic. And I would encourage anybody who's interested in poetry or just wants a good laugh and to learn a little something within the span of an hour to check that out. But I started looking at his work and finding different things that were published, and was just a fan at that point. And so when I was thinking about who to bring next, I thought Jose would be an interesting choice because not only is he somebody that I feel the community can learn from and just really enjoy him and his work, but I feel like he will challenge some of the people who come in a really beneficial way.
I have to tell you, I just have read a very superficial bio on him.
Mm-hmm.
But he brought to mind, I talked to a young guy whose family runs a restaurant on the South Side.
Okay.
And I was telling a friend of mine about him because we were eating in the restaurant.
Sure.
And I said, you know, this is a classic American immigrant story. His parents first came to the States as fruit pickers.
Mm-hmm.
And they gradually worked up to where they've now got this beautiful restaurant and $1 million building. And he said, oh, my God, that's a classic immigrant story. And I said, what I like about it is that it counters that prevalent narrative that we keep hearing. And it struck me that Jose's bio fits into that same notion.
Sure.
If you think you understand the immigrant experience and why people would come to this country... They don't come here because we have welfare, you know. Nobody's going to go to all that trouble and expend all that energy to come to this country and sit on a couch and watch stupid television shows that they could watch at home.
Sure.
So when I read the bio of somebody like Jose, who his parents were first-generation immigrants And he's a graduate of Harvard.
Oh, yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, except once in a blue moon.
Sure.
And you have to wonder, how exactly does a guy do that?
Right.
You know, I have a feeling he probably grew up in a Spanish-speaking household. So, you know, he's got a lot of hurdles he's going to have to cross in order to be able to make it as a poet at that level.
Oh, absolutely.
You know.
You know, out of Chicago, you know.
Uh-huh.
So definitely if you were to put together, like, the ideal movie treatment for how the story's supposed to work, you know, you're probably not going to put all of those things, you know, in succession. But, no, that's his story. And I think that, you know, so much of the conversation in the city for the past maybe 8 or so years has been about diversity and inclusion, and I think that that's fantastic. However, you know, you look at what kind of happens, what programs, even just what conversations we have, and they aren't very diverse or inclusive. You know what I mean? So
that's what you were saying before.
Sure.
You know, that division with one group going to Barnes & Noble and quite comfortable doing that, another group quite comfortable being downtown and hanging downtown.
Sure.
But how do you get people to cross that boundary?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know?
And that's...
And why should they?
Sure.
If they're comfortable doing what they're doing.
Well, I think that's the thing. And that's what I really... I'm interested in kind of partially addressing and attacking with the Rini series, because I don't want to bring somebody to town that on the other side of the coin, somebody's going to be like, well, any other organization here could have brought this person. Mm. I want to bring people that you're not going to find more often than not come to Chattanooga. And largely those writers are going to be writers of color. They're going to be writers who represent the LGBT plus spectrum.
And what do you think that is?
Well,
you know, people of color, as you put it, or LGBT, I never can get those initials right. are they less organized, less, you know, prepared to bring people in to represent their point of view or people they want to celebrate?
No, I don't think so. I think it's, and, you know, this is a huge question to tackle. But I think that I think typically when we're dealing with the literary arts period, most people have a certain person who's in mind who's typically going to be older, typically going to have X amount of books. And I think more often than not, those are going to be, you know, wider writers. I don't think that it's necessarily on a bunch of people's radars to say, well, I'm going to bring a writer who's not even 30 yet, who's, you know, won a good number of awards for their first book, who identifies as a they, you know what I mean? I feel like you really have to have a grasp and a foot on what's going on in contemporary poetry. And, you know, that's very much my bread and butter, you know.
And it seems to me that at least part of the impetus is to wrest it back from the hands of the academy.
Well,
because that's what you're describing, people who have books, people who are established in the community. Frequently, they're associated with the academy. They're teaching because the reality is it's rather difficult to make a living as a poet.
Sure. But I think that's the thing is the writers that I'm bringing, you know, a good number of them teach, you know, a good number of them represent the academy, but they represent the academy in a way that, you know, challenges a historical notion of you know, who's supposed to come out of these academic facilities. Like you mentioned Jose being at from Harvard, you're not necessarily going to automatically going to think of a Latinx young man wearing like a 5X white T-shirt, you know, and a Chicago Bulls hat cocked to the side who got into Harvard based on academics. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So part of it is I want to challenge the notion of what this looks and feels like, because what I'm doing, and not even just with the plug, I'm doing it in my own work too, is I want to bring possibility into it as much as possible.
And I think it's interesting that you are a teacher, you're a published poet, but you're not associated with the academy. you're taking a different approach to it.
Yeah, by choice, folks.
I know it. and I think that because you're taking a different approach, you're reaching people who you probably would have trouble reaching otherwise.
Absolutely.
Because they just feel the Academy is out of their reach. You know?
Sure. Well, I also think that, like, I think that there's that question of what does the Academy have for me?
Yeah, and Tiffany can answer that.
Yeah. Put you on the spot.
What brought you to the, we'll get back to you in a second, Christian. What brought you to the Academy, Tiffany? What made you decide that's what you wanted to do?
Part of it was a midlife crisis. And part of it was I was in Parks and Recreation. And what better place to be than Chattanooga for that industry? But I was working for the city, and I could not see myself doing that for the rest of my life. And I wasn't sure what else to do. I went then to work for Chat State and their recreation department. And then Ron Rash came and spoke and talked about his writing. And I started thinking about all of the poems and short stories that I had stacked away on my computer and in files, and how I loved it and how it inspired me. And
when did you start writing?
I seriously started writing on a regular basis, probably in high school. But I never, like I said, I never really showed it to people. I never shared. But it was something that I always did. And it was especially after I got a word processor, because my handwriting is horrid.
Oh, I know what you mean.
Oh, and
my handwriting is not much either. But there's also that thing of the word processors, so much less intimidating than a typewriter.
Yes, that too. Yes. So it was interesting. After I got that as a high school graduation gift, it just felt like it just flowed through me. But I always was sort of torn between the sciences and so outdoor recreation and the arts. And at that point, then when I was working at Chat State, I just said, I'm going to see what it will take to get a degree. And I think what drew me there was that I didn't have any, my previous experience, my previous degrees are in parks and recreation. They're not in anything artistic. So
What does that mean exactly to have a degree in parks and recreation? what does that entail?
It entails everything from being a park ranger to working at an organization like Outdoor Chattanooga, where you run kayak trips and hiking trips and those sorts of things for visitors and the public, to environmental education, anything that has to do with the outdoors, organizing the races and those kinds of things. It's all part of Parks and Recreation when I was in school.
What did you study? Biology?
I took some biology classes, yes.
What's the focus of a degree like that then? It's not necessarily that specific science, huh?
Right. No, it's not. And it's more, it has to do with management in the outdoors, which is different than management within a business, within a building. And there are other things to consider when that happens. So when you're trying to get a community to appreciate their outdoors, you have to make sure it's safe. You have to make sure it's healthy for the outdoors and for the people. And so learning all of that, I took classes in statistics and I took classes in management, recreation law, how to, you know, maybe navigate through things if they go bad. So it was so long ago. I'm trying to think. I did a thesis. I wrote a 100-page thesis on watchable wildlife and people, how important it was for people to visit outdoor recreation, like when they go on vacation. So how many people plan to go watch wildlife? How many people plan to go to a zoo or go bird watching or go in the ocean and swim or snorkel? That's all outdoor recreation. So how many people plan to incorporate wildlife into their vacation? And I didn't find anything shocking, but it was a learning experience, definitely. It was before email and electronic communication was prevalent, and so I was sealing up questionnaires and mailing them to people, and hundreds of them.
Well, it strikes me that for somebody to be good at what you did, and I assume you were, that you kind of have a foot in both. You're a scientist, but at the same time, you're an artist.
Right. And it's sort of been a struggle, because back growing up and in my early adulthood, I felt like I had to choose both. Mm. And so previously I did the outdoor stuff, and now I'm incorporating outdoor things and nature into my art, but that's not the only thing I'm paying attention to. And now the outdoors is more of my hobby and my relaxing, where the writing then is now my focus.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
Really cool that you managed to find a way to, because it sounds, especially given the poem you just read, that you still have in your mind one foot in both camps.
I do.
You know, you're very sensitive to, and on that topic, what really brought it home to me was a headline, I think it was in The Guardian over the weekend. They said, a new study is questioning, what is the world going to look like in 2050? Are we going to survive?
Right.
Are we going to survive? That's only that's only 30 years away.
I know. It's scary. And it's, I've always been concerned about it. I've always, you know, picked up trash off the side of the road and yelled at people for tossing their butts out the window. And, you know, those things, those recycling and all of those things. But now there are studies that say that's really not, it hasn't been as productive as what we thought it was going to be, like recycling and things like that. And it just blows my mind. It's scary, I think.
Sure is.
Yeah.
So that's something I imagine you spend a lot of time thinking about.
I do. Mm. Unfortunately. But to come back, I thought I could keep writing and work at my job and write, but I didn't know the process. And I feel as though I have learned quite a bit about the industry, the strategies writers use in order to produce quantity and quality. And I don't think if I had stayed in my little corner and just written stuff and submitted it, that I would have gained that knowledge.
That's where Christian comes in, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I wouldn't have met him if I hadn't have gone back to school. We met at Meacham a few years ago. So
I just had several people from the Meacham here last week.
Nice.
It's coming up next month.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of people I know are gaining the confidence in their work because of you, young Christian. Because I think that while a couple of your protégés who were here last week agreed that you hold them to a standard, that I don't think they find you intimidating in the same way. To be honest, the first time I walked into a college classroom here at UTC, I didn't have a high school diploma, so I couldn't take the class for credit. So I figured, I can audit this. I can handle this. It was a junior level poetry class. Mm. I think I made it through about a month. And I'm like, I don't even know what they're talking about.
Right.
You know? I don't think that you ever would have that response. I don't think anybody would react that way to the way you present poetry and the way you present your workshops. And I think that's such a service that you provide and in so many different forums. I mean, you've got the one in the summer, you've got Plug Poetry, you've got a lot of different things going on, a lot of different initiatives, don't you?
Sure. Yeah.
Is that because, in some sense, that's what you would have liked to have had?
Oh, absolutely. I tell people that, you know, in 2015, I had kind of like an epiphany. And I was on tour, I was in Boston, and I had won a really big slam at the Cantab Lounge, just like the champion of champion slams, which meant that I had to come back like a couple of months later and then, you know, try to win like the whole competition. And I ended up coming in second. But in the Uber back to the hotel, I just really started taking inventory about the journey and all the places it has allowed me to go and all the people it's allowed me to meet, all the lessons I've been able to learn. And I just thought, what if I were 15 again, what would I want to see in the city that I could just actively jump in? And that's where all of the programming since then has come about from, the summer workshop. In some way that has influenced the stuff that I'm doing with the plug as far as the events, the docuseries, but also the resources that I'm providing people. If people jump in the Facebook group, I throw in publication opportunities, grant opportunities. It's tax season right now, so there's like 31 tax write-offs for writers. I give people different things that if you want it, here's stuff that helps, you know. I don't want there to be any excuse. I think it is a way to try to appease some sort of like younger fictional, you know, version of me. So, yeah.
Would you care to share one of your poems?
Sure, I can. I feel like I have a trend the past few times I've come on here where I read a horror movie poem.
Do you really? I hadn't noticed.
Yeah, I'm gonna do another one. So I've been doing this series where I take Black characters from horror movies and I write poems around that. So this is called Blackula's Love Song. And if you're not familiar with Blackula, basically he's Black Dracula. That's really all you need to know. It's a persona poem too. I don't know much about the light hitting the Nile River anymore, but I know all there is to know about thirst. Ages ago, a monster colonized me, bit into the fine brown country of my neck, and made me one who cannot be quenched, one who knows the soft language of the night and holds forever in the prongs of my teeth. The red grotto of my mouth has held so much blood, so much death, but the sweetest things to have ever graced my tongue are the two syllables in your name, Tina. I don't know much about humanity anymore, but I know love is an unfed hound. Love, you placed your lips upon mine, poisoned the narrow veins coursing through the barrack of my body. The sorcery of your touch opened up a wound, filled the black rooms within me with sun, and made a killed man out of me long before the morning had a chance to.
How about you,
great.
Tiffany? But that's one of the sweetest horror stories I've heard in a while.
It. Yes.
Would you care to share another of yours, Tiffany?
Sure. In going to school, I took a fiction writing class, and one of the writers that we read from was Carmen Machado, and Her Body and Other Parties. I think that's what it's called, Her Body and Other Parties. And I fell in love, like my head blew open, you know, I just was wondering, you know, how is this possible? All of these mixes of genre and story and mythology and modern, you know, contemporary writing, and she put it all together and it was great. And then I got to meet her at AWP, which was even more awesome.
But, nice.
Yeah, so it was really
What's
nice.
What's AWP?
It's American Writers and Programs. So it's a big conference that meets all over the country each year. And it's writing programs, so universities that have writing programs, PhD, master's, undergrad, but also for writers and for publishing people.
Everybody coming together from all different fields.
It's like the largest writing conference in the nation.
Right. Yeah. So that was pretty exciting.
That's pretty cool.
I was a mess. Yeah.
So you got to meet one of your heroes.
I did.
What did you ask her?
So I had her sign my book, and I had just read this magnificent poem in The Sun. And I can't remember the title right now, but I remember the feeling, because in the session that we were in with Machado, she was talking about writing about body, she's about big bodies and small bodies and sensual bodies and how she writes about that. And this poem was about being in love and being fat. So it was an ode to fat. And so I went up to her, I asked her to sign my book, and I said, while you were talking and while I was in here, I really thought you would appreciate this poem. And so I showed her where she could find it. And she's like, thank you so much. Yes, I'll look into that. And when I had shared it with my brother, my brother is a rather large man, and he's like 6'8". And I mean, he's a really big guy. But I shared the poem, and he messaged me and he said, now, I don't know if I'm hungry or if I want to have sex. And I was like, oh yeah. And he's not a poetic, a poet or anything, but if it moved him like that, then I was just happy to share that with her too. So it was great. So I wrote a poem about Machado. So it's called Reading Machado. Under the glossy dust of my education and the deficiency thereof, behind my ignorance and laziness, I have found her. And she spoke to me, making declarations with humble words and monster philosophies, propelled by my eyes, fantastical whispers crawl on their bellies into my ears. They are snatched away by the suction of emptiness to be gripped by my brain. Altogether, they nestle in with a hot cup, broadcasting the motion picture to my body, feeling the sentiments as if tactile and coherent, leaving a niggle in my thoughts and voltage across my skeleton. I am slow and cannot catch its worth as quickly as I'd like, but it gets to where it's needed, landing somewhere amid my vessels and what makes me human. Words plucking the nerves on my neck, pilfering my breath and tickling a place in my gut. I don't move. Time is a hurried tizzy of a hummingbird.
Tiffany Herron is our guest, along with Christian Collier, and both of them part of the Plug Poetry event, which is this Saturday in the Edney Innovation Center.
Absolutely. Oh. Fifth floor.
Saturday, 6:30. So we started talking about Jose, and we didn't get very far. He's the son of Mexican immigrants. He grew up in Chicago and somehow made the leap to Harvard.
Sure.
How did he do that?
Brains and gumption.
With the emphasis being on the latter rather than the former, I suspect.
Well, I think that, you have to imagine a world that will accept you, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
It does.
You have to imagine yourself in spaces where you might not necessarily see yourself represented.
My wife has told me more times than I can count, if you can see yourself there, you can get there.
Sure.
But you have to see yourself there first.
Absolutely.
Because once you've seen yourself there, then you start acting as if you're already there.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you meet the people who can give you entree, they say, oh, I know you.
Sure.
You're one of us.
Yeah. I think,
but that's not so easy, right?
Oh, no. I mean, there are a number of other factors in that equation. But I think that especially when you're dealing with like younger people, like teenagers and everything. And now, the generation coming up now is very much like a show me generation. Like, you're telling me that I can do this. Show me what it looks like. So I think that it's really hard if you come from a community where, Harvard, sure, might not be in the realm of expectation, but even like maybe college, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So you have to imagine yourself beyond what you immediately see and encounter. And I think that is probably as vital of a step. James Baldwin in one of his books talks about kids who are in high school kind of hitting the ceiling of their life. Like, they realize, oh, this is probably it for what I can get for myself. And I think that it's really cool to just be able to imagine yourself like, no, like, yeah, sure, Harvard. You know, why not? You know? And then the kind of – because then, you know, even once you go through the steps and everything and you get there, you have to fight through that, do I really belong here? You know, there are all these kind of external factors and everything that are, like, working against me. And I have to show myself as well as these other people that I belong here. There's a poet, Philip Metris, and he has a book coming out later this year. Philip's incredible. But he told me that, you know, that the weird thing about place is that there is no place that is designed for anyone. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. And so there are a number of things that you have to work through in order to truly claim and believe that you belong anywhere. And I thought that was a really fascinating thing. But no, I think that that's probably as integral of a step as just having the tools to maneuver in a different environment.
I think
environment.
So, absolutely. I mean, Tiffany can probably attest to this too. Imposter syndrome is rife in the academy.
Sure.
The majority of people who have a PhD think they conned their way into it and that it's a mistake. How did I get these letters behind my name? So, I grew up, in in an impoverished situation. I grew up around kids who are like the kids you describe.
Sure.
I'm just trying to imagine anybody I grew up around saying, I'm going to go to Oxford or I'm going to go to Cambridge. First of all, they probably didn't even know they existed.
Right.
If they did, they wouldn't have the first idea how to get there, you know, literally,
sure,
as well as, you know, in terms of being accepted there.
Right.
So, okay, so we've got those two things. One is that it seems so completely alien to the world you grew up in. There's the imposter syndrome that everybody feels to some degree, especially in a place like Harvard or Yale. A friend of mine's daughter is at Yale right now, and she went through that. You know, the first year she was there, you know, I think it's probably true for a lot of kids. They're like, wow, what am I doing here? I don't belong here, you know? How does somebody like Jose navigate that? Have you talked to him about that?
I've not had the chance to. He did talk about it on a podcast that I listened to, and this was, you know, many moons ago, but he talked about, like, pretty much off the bat, realizing, like, oh, this is, I'm really going to have to kind of find my own way because, you know.
Yeah, does anybody here look like me, you know?
All right. Well, you know, he got to the dorms, and there's, like, you know, people's, you know, families, like, moving them into the dorm. Like, his dad put him on a plane and was like, all right, good luck, you know? So automatically you're like, well, there's a difference here in how we function. So I think, you know, just a matter of kind of like finding out, which I think that, you know, this is, you know, really indicative of the college experience anyway. Like, you have to find your own community. And if that isn't necessarily available, you have to find, you know, an advisor who can help you, you know, make a community and then find those people. And I think that that largely was his experience. I think he got very into activism while he was there and then, you know, probably found some sort of writing family too. You know, Jose is the product of Young Chicago Authors, which is the home of the Louder Than a Bomb poetry slam, which is like the largest teen poetry slam in the nation. So I think that that also provided some sort of community where it might not, you know, be able to see these people on a daily basis, but you can correspond. I think that that probably was a huge help too.
And that is perhaps when it comes down to it, as you were saying before, the attitude to poetry is so different in this generation. And so that gave him a route, right? That gave him a place where he could put his energies.
Sure.
And he felt maybe that, I mean, part of it is just the hubris of youth, right? I can do this. We all got that, you know, that's part of what, you know, gets all of us through and
right.
We're still here, you know. But it's interesting, you know, and I think you perhaps more than anybody I know can talk about how much the attitude toward poetry has changed in the last quarter century.
Hmm.
Hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, for one, it's become a lot more accessible, yeah. And not just in terms of like the language. I'm not even talking about that. I just mean like I literally can pick up my phone right now and I could find either a video of somebody doing a poem, a podcast of somebody like reading and talking about poems. I can scroll through Instagram and find a whole, you know, section of fragmented poems. Like I can encounter poems for a good part of my day if I so choose. Whereas before, if you rewind the clock, you know, you really probably had to, and this is before, you know, Amazon and all that, you would have had to go to a physical place like a library, you know, find a poetry book, check it out, and then run through it that way. So I think that not only is the accessibility so prevalent, but in the course of 10, 20 minutes, I can encounter so many different voices of poetry. You know, I can look at John Murillo. I can look at Jose. I can look at, you know, Mary Ruffel. You know, all in the span of, you know, 20 minutes, I can encounter all of these different people. And then if I wanted, I can work my way through their school of poetics and who influenced them and everything, right? So it's kind of – I'm kind of doing MFA-like activities on my own. I have the option to do it from – Starbucks or my bedroom or while I'm waiting to pick somebody up in the car, right? So I think that that is probably the biggest thing is it's, you know, it's so easy to find and then you can just immediately dive down into, you know, the architecture of what has made these people and their works what they are.
I think, you know, in some sense, poetry is like the new rock and roll.
I like that.
When I was 16, a friend of mine turned me on to Jack Kerouac. Mm. And through Jack Kerouac, I found Allen Ginsberg and Gregory Corso and all of the other beat poets. And my impression was that in America, in San Francisco at least, poetry had currency and poetry was hip. And poetry was some place where people were, it was alive and people were talking about it and people were moved by it,
right.
You know. And of course, there's Bob Dylan, you know. And maybe it's in part, at least, of what we were talking about before, you know, computers and social media and so on. But it seems as if we've now got that beat poetry notion writ large, you know. But the philosophers are the same, you know. These are street poets. These are people who talk in the language of people who are everyday. It's not high flown. It's not intended to obfuscate. Intended to communicate,
sure,
and to say something that everybody can understand and relate to,
sure.
Yeah.
And that's what you do. That's what you encourage, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like I encourage a number of things. Like I, as much as I encourage like the interest, like oh no, this is totally worthwhile, and you know, I would love for everybody to really come check it out. But I also encourage the development of skill. Mm-hmm. And I feel like so often, and I kind of feel like a number of people see poetry in the same way that they see rapping. Like anybody can do it. It might not be like the greatest like poem you've ever heard, but anybody can do it. Which A is not true, but B, like I feel like if you're operating off of that, then you automatically believe that like talent is the end all be all. And you know, I challenge that. Actively all the time because talent is fantastic, but none of us did anything to get talent. Talent just is, right? What you want, and this is, yeah, this is me like stepping on my soapbox and putting words in people's mouths, but I feel like what you ultimately want is to develop skill, which are tools and a skills, a knowledge base and muscles that will allow you to access these things at different points and achieve what you ultimately would like to. So that's what I encourage. I want, yeah, sure, get in the room, especially if you've never written a poem before. However, I want to show you some things that you can take with you for the rest of your days. You can apply across genre. You know, I want to expand your way of thinking about the work. And then maybe you can do some things that really surprise yourself and you see what you're capable of. And then who knows where that's going to set you off on. Right. So that's ultimately what I'm after. In what minor capacity I can, you know, try to like nudge people, say, hey, you might want to check this out. But Yeah, that's what I want. I want people to really see the skill in it, because I feel like once you chisel down into the craft of it, that's where you get the really great stuff, you know?
Absolutely. I agree. Was that your experience, Tiffany?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
So you were writing from high school. Mm-hmm. So you like writing, and you felt that at least in terms of expressing what you wanted to say, you could do that.
Yes. Yeah.
So at what point did you come up against what Christian's talking about, where somebody says to you, yeah, this isn't bad, Tiffany, but let's talk about craft here. Let's talk about the art of the craft.
Especially in the last few years, I've learned a lot about craft. I didn't know what that term was. I had talked about it a little bit with my high school teacher when I had written a few poems, and but nobody really would sit down and talk to me about it. They would just say, "Oh, that's good. Yeah. Oh, that's so cute. Yeah." But
so they weren't even taking you seriously?
No. Mm-mm, no. Mm-hmm. I this is so, I'm not trying to blast my parents, but there was one year that for Christmas I had made books of poems for them, and like had them bound and typed them all out and all this. And I don't even know if they read them. Mm. You know, I took them back too when I was visiting. but there wasn't anybody that would sit down and like talk to me about it until I came to UTC, and then it was exciting. It was really exciting to be able to sit down and talk to somebody about the craft and the choices that you have in order to put words together and make things feel a certain way and sound a certain way and tell a certain story all at the same time. Mm-hmm. It was great. It's wonderful.
It is, isn't it?
And yeah.
at the same time as that, oh, my God, I thought I knew how to do this.
Right, yeah.
I'm not sure I know how to do anything.
Oh, I wasn't
that's
so
where
certain,
you start,
but
isn't
still,
it?
Yes, that's where you start. Yeah. And you have to be open to that type of response, too, about talking about craft and not, like, just think your words are perfect.
Yes, learn to put up with critics.
Right, absolutely. Not everybody's right, but if they understand what you're trying to get across, if they're understanding, you know, what you're trying to actually say, then there's, you know, so much good information out there that people can respond to that with.
Sure.
It is so true. I've watched this man do it.
Right.
For a number of young poets, I spent a summer in Christian's class, watching him talk to young poets and helping them mm-hmm. find their voice. So before we run out of time, the Poetry Project is Saturday. It's at 6:30. You are featuring Jose Olivares, but he's not the only poet you're going to be featuring, is he?
No, we have two openers. Tiffany is one. Maul King is the other, and you know, people have probably encountered her works through the Spike Cafe, which is at Main Times 24. She's done a number of my events, and I've known her for I think 9 years now. Like, I went to the first event that she ever threw in Dalton, and she moved to town like a couple of years later, and we've just been trying to put different opportunities and everything before her, and now she's at a place where she really wants to step into as many of them as possible. So, yeah, she's going to be opening, and it's going to be a great time.
Very interesting. Is that her given name, Moll King?
That's what she goes by now.
Because Moll King, as you probably know, was a very famous 18th century poet.
Yeah, I think that's probably why she adopted it. Continuing on the lineage, and I think that that's one of the cool things about poetry. And I think that we've talked about that before, is that none of us are just writing into a vacuum. We're all, and this is me getting heady, but we're all in conversation with those who've come before, and maybe if we play our cards right, we'll be in conversation with those who come after. So lineage is very important.
I agree. And when Tiffany was saying earlier that, you know, you want to reach as many people as you can, I think many times, and I've had this conversation with so many writers, you really never know who's reading your work and who you're reaching. And unfortunately for many of us, we're probably going to reach a lot of people after we are no longer here to have that conversation with them directly.
Sure.
But we're still talking to them.
Right.
And that's what I think makes it such a powerful instrument. This is the time for you to say, this is an insight I've gained that I want to share with you.
Right.
And that insight works as well for three generations from now as it does for the generation you're writing to.
Absolutely.
Would you care to share another poem with us,
sure.
Christian?
This is one that...
What have you been doing differently?
I've been doing a number of different things. I put words together in a different way now, and I try to generate as many like lines or phrases without actually consciously thinking about it. Or we are all kind of programmed that we try to figure out some sort of story with everything. If we look at like two boulders in a museum next to each other, we're trying to figure out why they're close to each other, right? we're hardwired to narrative, and I try to keep narrative out of it as much as possible. I try to get like a lot of stuff and I try to put it together, and then I'll start looking at different connections. Still not even thinking about story, all of that. That's the last thing that I do. And then I'll just restructure lines. I'll repurpose lines. I'll sequence them differently. And then I end up with like a poem out of it. So it's really taking like the head, the automatic, like, oh, I'm going to sit down and write a poem today. I take that guy out of the equation. And then we get there through a series of exercises and everything. So this is one that emerged from that. And this one actually just got published by Timber Journal. So if people want to check that out, it's available. This is called Sauna. Here's what the white towel covering me knows. I am afraid of death. Yes. Of tripping out of life and beyond the speckled dark. I taste a little bit of the grave each time my chest muscles tighten and the next breath stands a mile beyond me. I am afraid of the day my lips could reach for it and only latch on to the three blank shells of an ellipsis. I know what it is to go without, and I am afraid I don't know what squander means when it comes to respiration. I live ever in search of oxygen and waste none I find. Asthma is the name of what eats away at me. Thief of the lungs that could one day rob me of you. Breath is a temporary beast. A frightened deer sometimes sprinting away and out of view. Here to tame it, I formed a refuge out of steam. That boneless dancer that only knows surrender. Only answers to the flow of its limbs. Inhale, then freeze. Allow the moisture to become medicine. I cleave to the apparitions birthed by this heat and invite them inside me in order to breathe, in order to not go dead among the living.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christian, Tiffany.
I have
to tell
me.
You, Christian, following up on what you were just talking about, I take that same basic approach to conversations
sure.
like the one we just had. And I always know I'm safe with you because I never know where the conversation's going to go, but I always know it's going to be interesting. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It's been such a pleasure to meet you and to
you too.
See you again, Christian.
Oh, thank you
very much.
It's good
as
to
always.
See you.
Appreciate it.